Good morning, everyone. Friday, August 21st, and here's a roundup of the news brought to you by NBC reporters at home and overseas. This morning finds fighting along the broad Russian front continuing, so we turn first to Moscow for the report of Robert Magadorf.
Sent to Moscow, calling the next...
Here is a short story from Berlin. The German news agency DNB says Russian air raiders were over wide areas of German-occupied Poland during the night. And now let's try to contact Moscow once again. NBC New York calling Moscow. Come in, Robert Magadorf, in Moscow.
This is Robert Magadorf speaking from Moscow. Endless columns of fresh German reinforcements are coming up to the Donbass as Hitler is making an all-out effort to crash his way towards Stalingrad. At least one German tank division and one infantry division have been sent up to this area in the last couple of days. This, in addition to thousands of fresh Italian, Hungarian, and Romanian troops. Also, the Luftwaffe has been reinforced and is steadily battling the Soviet lines on the eastern as well as western bank of the Don. But the Russians have not budged an inch in the last 24 hours on any vital sector. It is not yet known how many German troops got across the river last Wednesday. It must have been a considerable force, though. The first detailed accounts of the battle that ensued on the eastern bank of the Don bespeak a most bitter encounter. Here's what happened. As soon as the Germans got across, they began to dig in feverishly and build pillboxes in preparation for a drive toward the Volga. But the Russians lost no time in counterattacking. Heavy Soviet tanks charged into the midst of the Germans, crushing men, trucks, and guns. A savage bayonet attack followed. The enemy tried to get back across the Don, but was pursued by artillery, trench mortar, and machine gun fire. The river turned the color of blood. Most of the Germans were wiped out. The others are being mopped up, but it...
Ray Henley of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette covers domestic developments for us now, speaking from our own nation's capital, Washington.
What? Wendell Willkie, as you know, is going to Russia, and to Persia and Egypt. He will perform certain services, as he puts it, for the government. Expects to see Stalin and other leaders. In Washington, we believe a sentence of Mr. Willkie's announcement gives one real clue on why he is making this trip. I think, says Mr. Willkie, that now and in the future, America is going to work in close cooperation with these countries and their leaders. It is well known that Mr. Willkie favors international cooperation after the war, and that he believes this country must get into it more than ankle deep. There can be little question that he is becoming a world traveler again to fortify himself with first-hand knowledge on an issue which this country has to face in the days to come. And it's an issue on which Mr. Willkie obviously intends to have his say. Meanwhile, the Republicans in Mr. Willkie's home state of New York are getting ready for their state convention, which is expected to nominate Thomas E. Dewey for governor. Mr. Willkie and Mr. Dewey have not seen eye to eye on the international issue. And it will be interesting to watch how much support, if any, Dewey gets from Willkie. There's some more news this morning on the tussle between the War Production Board and the military services for control over the war production program. I told you earlier this week that the Army-Navy Munitions Board has power to say who will get top ratings on certain critical, hard-to-get materials. This power has given military men a real grip on the American arsenal and lets them say how war goods are scheduled for production. This morning, the Washington Post, in a front-page article, says that in line with Mr. Nelson's announced get-tough policy, he has decided to reassert his authority over both materials and scheduling. Even, and I quote the Post, even if it involves a knockdown, drag-out fight with the military. And the International News Service says today that Mr. Nelson is shaking up his organization, weeding out deadwood, and that some 15 to 20 board officials will be discharged. You recall I reported to you the other day that this Army-civilian struggle for authority has not yet seriously delayed the war program. And the International News Service reports this morning that Mr. Nelson is prepared to tell the nation, and I quote again from the Press Association story, that despite all the confusion in official Washington, production of planes, tanks, guns, and ammunition increased about 4 times in July over November of last year. That's from the INS. Now, whatever record has been made, and there is every indication that it has been remarkable, it stands to reason the record will be even better without confusion and with better understanding between the War Production Board and the military men. Many people here think it's high time for them to get together. And that's all from Washington.
Next, across the Pacific to Martin Agronsky with General MacArthur's headquarters somewhere in Australia.
Today's press reflects Australia's power to recover from a severe blow, and in the same breath, it reflects the nation's inflexible resolution to carry the attack to the enemy. Leading articles mourn the loss of the cruiser Canberra, while editorials continue to stress the necessity of Allied offensive operations. The Daily Mirror says, now and through the remaining months of 1942, there is a prospect that war will be conducted by both Britain and America in a spirit of attack, with incursions against Axis powers in many places and bold pushes of Allied reinforcements into disputed theaters. Assertion of Allied power in offensive is indeed imperatively necessary. Britain in Europe and Africa, and America with Australia in the Pacific, can stand no more of being thrust back. In the teeth of Axis resistance, British convoys have smashed their way through in the Mediterranean, and American convoys reached the Middle East. Britain's Dieppe raid was a big incident occurring during the U.S. Solomon Islands campaign. These are expensive operations. The Canberra was part of the price. But the Allies declare themselves in terms of power and resource, and the damage steadily done to the enemies begins to look like more than the enemies can afford. Writing on the commando raid on Dieppe, the Sydney Sun comments in a similar vein. This paper says, it indicates the rising power and offensive spirit to which all freedom-loving men look for eventual liberation. Continuing the pressure against Timor, Allied bombers effectively raided Malbisi, a small town which was pointedly described in today's communique as an area occupied by the enemy. All bombs reached target destination, and large explosions indicated that fuel ammunition dumps had been hit. Japanese soldiers were seen scurrying for the shelter of the jungle as the Allied bombers dropped their loads. Meanwhile, Australia's growing bomber output was announced today by the Minister for Aircraft Production. He said, Australia is now producing more planes each month than were turned out by most of the large manufacturers in Great Britain and America before the war. We have reached a point where we have embarked on quantity production of torpedo bombers, which challenge comparison with similar aircraft produced in the world's greatest centers, the minister added. Already large numbers of Beauforts are being delivered to the Air Force, and the trickle of a few months ago is now becoming a flood, and the cost of producing planes in Australia is lower than if they were imported. It's the Sydney Albright speaking from Australia.
Our roundup continues as we turn to the Middle East. Grant Parr reports direct from Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. In the days when Italian troops were being captured in droves, and not too unwillingly, several hundred were sent back under escort of a Ben carrier, which headed up the column. Just behind the carrier, trudging along in the soft sand, was an Italian general. The farther he walked, the hotter he became. And finally, he asked to be allowed to ride. After all, I'm a general, you know, he said. The Ben crew were very nearly persuaded, when suddenly a distinctly American voice issued from somewhere in mid-column. Let the old fool walk. Investigation showed that the voice was that of a young Italian who had lived for years in Detroit. He had been conscripted while on a visit to Italy, but he didn't think much of Mussolini's war. But it wasn't until the United States Army started to build workshops in Eritrea that we began to remember the bombs which before the war bound many Americans to Italy and many Italians to America. These American workshops are noted for conserving tools, materials, and men. Men in particular are hard to get, for a single passenger takes a good deal of shipping space. Faced with this manpower problem, officers in charge of the Eritrea project discovered that there were among the Italian colonists a number who had lived in the United States as long as 12 years. They spoke good English, and many had had experience on mechanical jobs in American factories. These men, with their families, had been persuaded to return to Italy by propaganda they had read about the coming greatness of their homeland. Italy, they thought, needed men and would pay them well. Once in Italy again, they found they had been deceived, that conditions were far worse than anything they had faced in America, even during the Depression. But again, they heard tales of greener pastures elsewhere. There were wonderful opportunities for colonists in Eritrea. To anyone who had lived in America, that term colonist sounded good. So off they went to Eritrea, and another disappointment. The upshot has been that these Italians, who like America and Americans, are working and working well on Allied war jobs. They are well paid and promoted if they merit it. As a result, many have wholly transferred their divided loyalties to America. I now return you to New York.
And our final report comes from John McVain, speaking from London.
This is London. The Dieppe raid details still take up most of the news columns in today's British papers and form the subject of most conversations. The fact that army authorities allowed a full quota of press and radio correspondents, photographers, and movie cameramen to go along has given the action all the descriptive reports that it deserved. Commentators here are stressing that Dieppe doesn't mean a second front is imminent. For instance, the Daily Herald says no layman is entitled to conclude that the United Nations are prepared to open and sustain a second front. But on the other hand, no Nazi is entitled to assume that the Allied offensive is a remote possibility. The Herald says Allied troops were told to occupy a portion of France for a strictly limited period, then withdraw. But German troops have never for an instant occupied an inch of British soil. The Herald says, such is the cheerful truth. Its significance must not be exaggerated. The Daily Express declares there is new confidence in Britain, new faith that we have in our hands the means for speedy victory, because we've had action, and the Daily Express says, action with the British breeds cheerfulness. The tonic effect of the raid is noted by most commentators, and some stress is laid on the news that the RAF brought the Luftwaffe to battle and crippled a third of the German fighter strength in Western Europe. The balance of planes lost and damaged was about even. But you will remember that in the Battle of Britain, when the Luftwaffe tried to come to this island, the RAF shot them down at the rate of 3 or 4 for 1. I'll never forget the pleasure and confidence that the sight of those Spitfire squadrons over Dieppe gave us. The tense second or so after you see a new plane coming at you, and the relief when it turns and you see the graceful, familiar shape of the Spitfire wings, form an experience that thousands of fighting men will always remember. The air battles and the size of the force that the RAF threw into the combat are being taken today as an indication of how great an air effort a major offensive would require. The Daily Telegraph says the task is well within the power of the United Nations, but they must realize its magnitude. It's being emphasized that the Dieppe raid was carried out not by picked commando troops alone, but by ordinary army units. The Daily Sketch says Dieppe has proved the learning stage is nearly over and the army is growing up. The paper notes that the Germans speak contemptuously of the amateurist nature of the operation, and the sketch adds, they're quite correct, as are amateur armies. But just as our amateur armies drove the German professionals out of France in 1918, so our amateur armies will surely drive out the professionals again. This is John McVain in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
These were the reports of Robert Magadoff from Moscow, Ray Henley from Washington, Sidney Albright from Australia, Grant Parr from Cairo, and John McVain from London. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.